All right, we are back. This is How Have You Not. I'm Frank.
Daniel.
And it's Stranger Things 2, y'all! Part 2. All right, so we're back. We're back with the second part of our Stranger Things episode. We apologize for some of the technical difficulties you may have noticed at the end of our last episode. We're still kind of figuring out this podcast thing a little bit, and our mic was definitely somehow was turned down way too low towards the end of the episode. So we apologize for those difficulties, but we will we'll do our best to make sure that they don't happen again. So yeah. So as we were recording this episode, it's a few days towards till Christmas, and with Christmas comes a lot of different traditions of what different people and different families like to watch, and come the classic Christmas specials that most of us have been watching most of our lives.
The Star Wars Christmas special.
I've never actually seen the Star Wars Christmas special.
It's pretty bad.
I've read a lot of articles about it.
I feel like we're going to get a cease and desist letter just for talking about it.
We're going to get a cease and
desist. Because I feel like Lucasfilm doesn't want anyone to know it exists.
Well, yeah, well, it didn't exist. I mean, it's
on
never,
YouTube.
Yeah, it's never been re-aired anywhere. I mean, it's one of those things that after it was shown, it would never re-air it again. But so, you know, certain people recorded on early VHSs, and it kind of got passed around. And of course, now we can upload basically anything on the YouTube, so it's up now. But do you your family have a favorite Christmas special, or it's just something that you'd like to watch during the Christmas season?
Not really. No, I mean nothing consistent. If it's on TV, maybe we'll watch. It's a Wonderful Life, but people don't really watch TV anymore. No, it's very on demand, so you have to want to look for it, right?
Yeah, but also you can also find anything on demand. The good part about
there's
it.
There's not a limited amount of material that's on TV now that it'll just come across it, you know?
Yeah.
What I'm saying.
Yeah,
also,
my
you
mom
don't
stole.
Get a TV guide anymore that tells you when things
Oh, gosh, TV guide. Certain people might not even know what that is after a certain age.
Yeah.
Yeah, my mom is still the kind of person that still watches It's a Wonderful Life every year. I have one thing that I definitely like to watch every year, and it's definitely a 90s kid thing. You won't know it because you're an unfortunate soul that didn't grow up with cable, which causes most of your How Have You Nots. The Hey Arnold Christmas special. It is really my favorite Christmas special of all time. It's actually become more poignant than it was when it premiered like 20 years ago, and it's actually kind of more poignant now. If you know, in the show Hey Arnold, Arnold lives in the boarding house with his grandparents, and he lives kind of in the boarding house with all these interesting characters, and one of them, and they're doing Secret Santa, and one of them is this older Vietnamese man named Mr. Nguyen, and he doesn't know what to get him, and he asks his friend Gerald, what should I get this guy? And he said, well, why don't you go talk to him, figure out what he wants, what he likes. So Arnold does, and he gets the story about how Mr. Nguyen escaped Vietnam in the 70s, and how he had to put his daughter on a helicopter with the soldiers and to get her out of Vietnam. He's never seen his daughter since. So Arnold spends the rest of this Christmas special trying to find Mr. Nguyen's daughter out throughout the whole city of New York, and it's that kind of trek that he goes on. And if you've ever seen Hey Arnold, you know that there's a girl on the show named Helga who pretends to hate Arnold but is actually obsessively in love with him and has a shrine to him in her closet and all these kind of weird stalkerish things that would never fly in 2017, but we didn't really know better about in the late 90s. And towards the end, she actually gives up something that she really wants to help Arnold get his wish on Christmas. And it's a really poignant thing considering, you know, what we're going through with refugees and immigrants in this country. And, also with, kind of struggling every year with the materialism of Christmas, it actually feels more poignant now than it did 20 years ago. But actually, I know a lot of people who watch Star Wars during Christmas. Like, that's the one they save up.
Okay, yeah.
They save up.
Go ahead.
They save up Star Wars every year, and they watch the trilogy during Christmas. And this is kind of a real thing that people do when they have what's known in some circles as trilogy time. I don't know why I'm doing air quotes. We're not going to see me doing this. But now that Star Wars has kind of become a Christmas thing, or as much a summer thing, a lot of families are like waiting until like Christmas Eve or Christmas Day to go see Star Wars as a family.
Have you heard of the machete order?
No.
Okay, so my sister sent me this video, not video, this article. It's called from nomachetejuggling.com. So it is the Star Wars suggested viewing order.
Okay, I have heard of this order, yes.
So it's comparing the release order and the episode order. So you're saying release order would be 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 7, 8, right?
7, Rogue One, 8.
Yeah. Yes. So episode order would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know. That, so they're saying that the story, the way the story has been written, it doesn't work because George Lucas wanted the story to be about Anakin Skywalker, but the story arc doesn't really hold true because it weakens Darth Vader as the enemy.
Yes.
He is the antagonist in the original trilogy. So when you see him as a little boy and as a whiny adolescent, it doesn't strengthen his character. But if you watch it out of order, it gives you insight. So they're suggesting, the machete order is 4, 5, 2, 3, 6. So they're saying don't watch episode one anymore.
Yes, I have heard of this order. I didn't know the name, but I have heard of this order.
Basically, it's saying that it's not that it's a terrible movie, but it doesn't really need to be watched in order for a viewing party. So you would watch A New Hope and then Empire. Then while you're seeing Luke, you know, and all this struggle with him, then you get to see his father and, you know, going through all of this. So which makes it more interesting when you watch 2 and 3, then you watch 6, which is a Return of the Jedi. You see Anakin Skywalker turn before he dies. So it's an interesting.
Yes, I have heard of the order of the machete order. I didn't know that's what it was called, but it is something that I have heard of.
I don't know why it's called machete order, but.
Because it hacks away, maybe, at what the order is. And I know a lot of people who I think most people love Rogue One. And then I know that most older people are kind of divided on it because they say, oh, it's just an action movie. Like, yes, that's the point. It's supposed to be a war movie.
These are all still
that's the point.
Space fantasy, so.
Yes, but I know a lot of people who just love that movie because they get back to Darth Vader at his essence, kicking ass. So, and I brought up Star Wars because that's kind of what we do on this show, but next week is when it's going to happen. Me and Daniel dishing all of our opinions about The Last Jedi. I think you know Daniel's opinion already, given that he's seen it 3 times already, like a giant nerd that he is. But we're going to dish everything about The Last Jedi, what we thought, how we felt about everything, what do we think about the characters. We're going to address some of the controversies that have been going on throughout the media and throughout the fandom. Probably going to smack a few down and maybe open up some more controversies. But we're going to be doing that next week. And also, this is not the only podcast we're probably going to record on this. We think that this movie has a lot to say about where we are in culture. It has a lot to say as far as as where we are kind of as fandoms who we've become used to kind of creating our own content. I mean, that's kind of what we're doing here.
Well, and the truth is the fandom is very different because it is different generations.
Yes.
And different people have seen it in different times because it's been around since 1977. So it is an interesting, because as each generation kind of comes of age and accepts or embraces this fandom, right? This storyline, they feel differently about how it affects them, so they don't necessarily resonate with the same things that the previous generations have. So I really want to talk to some people that are younger than us about what they think about Star Wars in general.
Yeah, because I think there's definitely is a conflict between people in our generation and people older than us. About the especially these last 3 movies and really what does the younger generation think of Star Wars? I mean, are they embracing it as theirs the way kind of we did and the way the generation before then did? We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about how Star Wars figures into race and politics and gender. Those are kind of usually the things that Daniel gets into, but we're going to make him get into it now with this. And I'm in seminary right now at Bright Divinity School, and this is pretty much all I'm ever into. So we're going to start to explore that next week. But for now, We're going to finish up with Stranger Things 2, which we went into in somewhat painstaking detail in the last podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. I enjoyed doing it, and I really enjoyed going back listening to it, and I hope you did too. But all right, Stranger Things 2. So as we left off last time, Hopper's been Joyce and Bob have found Hopper, and he's, you know, going back to the hospital and then the lab. Will has freaked out after the I guess for the lack of a better word, the soldiers in Hawkins' lab have shot these flamethrowers at these places, and he's gone into convulsions.
I still, at this point, you can't trust anything Will does, because is he reacting as a shadow monster to try to fool everyone into him? You know, I think at this point, we don't see much of Will, we see mostly the shadow monster.
And really, I knew something was going on with Will, but definitely, I couldn't really grasp it all, because It was so well done and so subtle that you didn't really, something was going on with him, but you didn't know. Yes, you didn't really know how dangerous it was. I mean these kid actors are so great, and like I said, I love that he kind of turned out to be still the smallest of the kids, and it makes him more unassuming. It makes him almost more of a threat because he is so small. But
well, and also he's a victim, so of course his mother is going to try to protect him. But it's interesting to have the victim be this. It kind of has an exorcism kind of.
Yes, I definitely going. I mean, we're not going to break everything down as episode by episode. We're just going to jump in here. It really did have so much of an exorcist quality to what was going on, and kind of really put more of a horror element into the show. Of course, they had
to
go
to the creepy cabin to do it and turn on all the gear. So they realized that the shadow monster and I guess we can call it the shadow monster in general because it's a hive mind, hates heat and hates, I don't know particularly what it is about heat, but the tendrils and they use fire to try to destroy and
he likes it cold.
Yeah. They try to keep the gate from encroaching even further into the lab, and what happens is that Will sells him out. He gives him a false plan.
Yeah, and it's really
terrible.
I think it's the darkest moment of the show so far because these kids have been kind of,
which I don't even believe Will there. I think Shadow Monster is trying to make them feel bad for Will so that they don't kill Will.
Yeah, I mean, because he has to stay alive.
Will was gone.
Yeah, and when they figure this out, they would
say, "Sorry, my son's gone." Whatever.
I mean, they figure out that either they got to get this thing out of Will or they got to kill Will. And of course, they don't. Joyce is not going to have that, so they have to get this thing out of Will before they can do anything else. Or else, if they kill this thing, it's going to kill Will. So I think it's probably the darkest thing that happens in the show so far, when you have all these men kind of tricked into going in this cavern and then all getting killed. And then I love the part I think it's in episode 8 where the demo dog is trying to break the glass and Dr. Owens is like, the glass will hold, and then they start to crack and Hopper's like, you sure about that, right? Doc?
Yeah. So another thing I think is pretty cool is that we go back to the bus from season 1. So they're back hunting the Demogorgon. So, but there's something about, I don't know what, it reminds me of, in a war movie, before the attack, everyone has that moment to talk and speak their mind and talk from the heart. So, of course, we hear a little bit from Lucas and Max, and she talks about her brother and all that other stuff.
As far as story goes, I think this is where the show goes to another level of brilliance, because in episode 6, I feel like I'm starting with Star Wars when we're talking about these episodes, but in chapter 6, we start to see these stories dovetailing, and we see, Max and Lucas have kind of been on their own story for a couple of episodes, and we finally see them come back in with Dustin's story, where Dustin's, where he's been with Steve, and they're like, Steve Harrington? What are you doing with Steve Harrington? And it's just as almost surprising to them as it is to us as viewers that Steve, of all people, is helping Dustin. We see them and we see Steve give Dustin some terrible advice about women. It's like, just ignore them, they'll eat it up, which I've been told all my life works, but I've never actually been able to do it, and I've never actually seen it work. To me, girls want as much attention as you give them, but then again, The other big thing to me that happens in episode 6 as far as boys and girls go is that Jonathan and Nancy finally do it.
Oh, okay.
But really, this storyline has been going on since the end of last season, where you see that these two characters have chemistry. You see the Ron and Hermione element that you brought up in the last episode, and you see the point where Murray is just laughing at them and he's like, man, I've heard some crazy things since you two got here, but that's the first lie that I've heard. Yeah. But it kind of, and in a way, it's actually really good story-wise, because it kind of brings that story to an end, and it gets them to the point where they can go back to the rest. They don't have any more
conflict. They need to, the funny thing is, don't they have a bit of a moment of truth when they're leaving, and they kind of have to, they're not in this funny little hippie van anymore, and they can, they have to realize that they don't really belong. It's the same thing they dealt with before. And when they go back to real life, do they stick together or do they have to?
Yeah, that's something. I mean, I think that's something that we're gonna have to see as far as how this episode, as the series continues, is that they go back into conflict, and they go straight to the lab after they leave Murray's, and then they find it, all dark and power outage, and then they run into Steve and the rest of the kids, and everyone's kind of united. And then the other big thing that happened in episode in chapter six, or is this in chapter six or is this later?
Chapter 6 is the spy, so.
And is this when Bob dies?
No.
Or is this later? Is it later on where
Bob doesn't die until episode 8?
Okay. But you see the things are getting really bad, and we see the soldiers that have died, and we see that towards the end of episode of chapter six, things have really, really gotten bad, and then we have this detour, and we're going.
So did you like episode seven? Sorry, chapter seven, The Lost Sister.
We get into the biggest controversy of the season. This whole little 11 story takes over the entire show.
So why do people not like it?
Well, from what I've read, most of the dissatisfaction from the fandom about chapter seven. See, I can't stop doing it. Of Stranger Things 2 is that 11 goes on this whole tangent and it kind of takes away from the rest of the story. And
I don't think it does.
Yeah, I don't think that either.
I feel like they had to. Okay, well, let's be real. She has to come back stronger than she was. And she came back, emotionally, mentally stronger. But as far as her power, as far as her discipline and her training, there was nobody in the story who could teach her how to do that. So they had to put somebody out there that could teach her. So, of course, she sees this girl, Callie, in her vision, and goes to see her. And they teach her how to use her power.
Yeah, it's...
I think it's pretty cool. I think it was an interesting way of telling that story. I don't think that was the only way they could have done it. Because they could have had her go to the lab and read a ton of, the paperwork and the studies about the children. That would have been another way for them to give information to her on how to use her powers.
Yeah.
But I don't think anyone at the lab quite understood her powers.
I think the only one who did was Brenner.
But even then, they never thought she was going to open the gate.
I don't. Are you sure about that? I'm pretty sure that Brenner was trying to use her to open the gate.
Do you think?
I think he was. I think part of what Brenner was doing is he was using 11 to open the gate. I think that's part of why she's so regretful.
Do you think Brenner is a part of the Shadow Dimension?
No, I think Brenner.
Why would they want to open the gate?
I think Brenner wanted to see what was beyond that gate. He wanted to access and try to weaponize the things that we're seeing the upside down.
I think they were Brenner trying to wanted weaponize to weaponize the children.
Really?
And use them, because remember they were trying to get them to listen in on the Soviet conversations?
Oh, yeah, you're right.
So the children were weapons for the Cold War, I think. And I think that this was just her. They were trying to train her to have that.
And you think that she ripped the gate open accidentally,
yes,
basically?
Yes, I do. And then they have this problem that they have to contain, but obviously they didn't. So.
Yeah. So, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but yeah. And also, I think a lot of people have talked about how, the characters in that 11 encounters, they're kind of one-dimensional, kind of stereotypical. But then again, this entire show is built on stereotypes. And then, of course, these children, they talk about in Beyond Stranger Things, they're based on The Warriors, which is an early 80s cult classic movie that was made into a video game about 10 years ago. And it's kind of, there's this classic scene in there where a line where, if you've never seen that movie, and I don't think I ever have, where they know it. Oh, warriors, come out and play. And that's kind of the classic line from that movie, and that's kind of what these kids are based on. And, they've attacked them as kind of a plot device, and they say I've heard say it's kind of like a B-movie plot, and it's not really... But I think given what we've seen throughout this season, where Eleven's really kind of on a hero's journey, on that kind of archetypal hero's journey that we see, or that series we see kind of start in the flashbacks, where she goes to Mike's house, and then she realizes that she can't go back there. And she has to go on this journey, which leads her to Hopper, and she kind of tries to, she finds a home there for a while, but then she realizes at some point that she has to go and to find herself. Whether unconsciously or consciously, she knows that she has to leave.
Well, he's not giving her what she needs.
No,
she's allowed to watch TV, but...
She doesn't have the space to really find herself, because
she's
been unprotecting
her. Socialized.
No.
So going through, and she's wearing this, country, overalls.
These oversized, dirty clothes and things like
really...
that.
It doesn't suit her as the hero. She doesn't look like a hero. But when
no.
she comes back, she has this weird 80s Matrix outfit on,
Yeah, kind of. It kind of looks like the kind of stuff I used to wear in high school, honestly.
It suits the badass that she has to become to overcome,
Yeah, and even Hopper says, you know what? I kind of like this look. And then we get the classic line.
Well, and I think it's even cooler that she has, I don't know. I don't really care about going in order because... They do go to this, it's like an old trope from the 80s, she's Ally Sheedy, who, she gets a makeover during the Breakfast Club. She shows up at the Snowball.
Yeah, just a little bit.
But
there's just a little bit of Ally Sheedy in there.
There's nothing wrong with that, because that's what she wanted in season one, if she didn't get that.
Yeah,
and
really...
she really just wanted to have a moment with
Mike,
because... They don't care who else is there.
No,
they're not there to be seen. She didn't do that to make him feel like... She didn't do it for him. She did it for her. And
yeah.
I think that's why
we... I think that's a big thing that we really... That's really... You really look at about 11. and in this story is that she gets to Chicago, and I love that it's in Chicago, which is where most of the classic, you know, classic 80s teen movies, all the John Hughes movies are set in Chicago, and it's really kind of the mecca of that genre. So I love that she ends up there. And we see the Sears Tower, which I visited a couple months ago when I was in Chicago. And we see her going to this deep underbelly where she meets these people. And I really did love the character of Callie as a kind of a compliment to Eleven, as a kind of a villain. And I think you needed a character like that to show just who Eleven had become. Because Callie and her gang, she kind of paints... She paints the gang as, you know, lost children and lost boys and all these things, and they've been discarded by society, and they're making these preemptive strikes against these against the people in Hawkins' lab, and
kind of little group of people. They're looking out for each other, but because, I mean, the children are involved. She's involved because she has to be, because they're protecting her, but she doesn't need protection, but she does need...
She needs emotional support.
Yeah.
She needs a family.
And
these are the closest, and these people have become the closest thing, and they need her. They need someone to protect them and to take care of them and to nurse them back to health. And it's a very, it is very Dickensy in a very dystopian fashion.
And how hard is it really to write a character like Eleven, who she has this problem, but she's ultimately powerful as they want her to be at any given moment.
But she's also a blank slate.
Yeah, but I'm saying, like, for her, what is going to be challenging for that character? Like, because any amount of violence, she's like, she usually will win.
Yeah, she can throw down.
They have to create conflict for that character that's not physical.
Yeah, you're right. And she wouldn't...
She can kill a hall full of soldiers. She can flip a truck. You know, she can do so many different things. So what can overwhelm her?
And
what they do is that, you know, they can knock her unconscious, but that's about it, you know?
Yeah, and all the things we've seen, she gets overwhelmed by emotions. I mean, she got overwhelmed by her emotions, and she broke all the windows in Hopper's cabin. She got overwhelmed by emotions, and she finally flew the coop to go see Mike after wanting to for almost the whole year.
Well, they've kind of created this storyline where she can be overwhelmed by fatigue.
Yes.
And that her power
as time goes on, she's getting better at conquering that fatigue.
And that's an interesting thing to talk about in these kind of stories, is that certain characters have certain canon, let me put it that way, the magic, if we want to call it that, is at a cost or it isn't. So in Harry Potter, the magic is around and they just harness it. It's within them.
Yes.
So using magic doesn't necessarily fatigue them. But in, like, The Lord of the Rings, when Gandalf uses magic, it is fatiguing. He can only do so much because there's a physical element to it. I feel like Eleven, there must be some physical cost to her using her power, because she gets a nosebleed. So there's some...
Yeah,
there's some physical tie in. So it makes me wonder if what is the ultimate toll taken on her physical body?
Yeah, what are the rules of this power that she has?
And I think that's what makes it interesting.
Yeah, I think we see that she's getting better at using her power, but I don't think we still know all the rules to her power. And I think as we go on to future seasons, that's one of the things that's going to be interesting to find out. What are the limits to Elf's power? Can it be harnessed in a way? Can she be overwhelmed? Can she lose her powers? That's a classic archetype that we've seen throughout these kind of fantasy stories.
Sometimes these characters become depressed and they lose their...
Yeah.
You know, it's like Tonks in Harry Potter. She gets depressed and she's all mousy and she doesn't have her abilities.
And what I really got from episode 7 is really kind of who Elle had become, because she meets up with these vigilante people and really in the scene where they go into the convenience store and they're robbing the convenience store, I really start to see that, you know, these aren't lost boys, these aren't freedom fighters, these aren't revolutionaries, they're criminals.
Yeah.
Because they're going in and they're robbing a store when they don't have to. I mean, Callie probably has the powers to make it where they can get out without any type of violence or anything like that. But they want the violence. They want the conflict. They want to destroy things.
They're anarchists.
They're anarchists. And they don't have... And, you know, Callie keeps on saying to Eleven, or as we kind of find out, her name is actually Jane, but, you know, I'd like Eleven more.
Well,
but
it's just her identity.
Yeah.
What is her identity?
And... So we see that, and we see she's always saying, "I used to be just like you," you know, she's, you know, this is a constant refrain that she has, and when And when they get to this guy's house and they start and they you know, they're about to unleash hell on him, and Eleven has him in this basically, what, for the lack of a better word, a force choke, and is bossing him around, and then they find out there's children in the house, and you know, she makes a decision to not kill this guy.
And how old is she? 11.
Guessing
12, 13.
13, 14 meet at the
oldest. Because having that's not an adult.
No.
And I think having the ability to look at and empathize enough to see this is wrong.
Yeah.
Because she hasn't been taught what was right and wrong until she was with Hopper.
Yeah, and we see, and that's the biggest thing that I really got from this whole detour in Chapter 7, is that we see that Eleven knows right from wrong. We see that she's been taught something.
Her developmental stages are very uneven.
Yes.
In some ways, she's 8 years old.
Yes.
Emotionally, she's 8 years old, you know?
We see that with the tantrums and with the desire to eat junk food all the time. And I love, there's a really funny part where she picks up an apple in the store and then she sees a box of egos and then just gets three boxes of them and kind of gets ready to pig out. And I really think it was necessary. I mean, you say she could have gone in the lab, but I think in a lot of ways this was the only way, because she's been on this journey throughout the entire season and she had to go somewhere. She had to get outside the world of Hawkins and then outside the world of friends to really see how that was worth. It's kind of the classic archetype of story, is that you don't recognize what home is until you leave it.
True.
And she gets to this end of this episode and she's decided to leave these people and then they get caught by the police and they bug out.
Well,
and we don't see them again for the rest of the season. And you know, one of the questions for going forward is, do these people come back? Does LC eight again? Does Jane see Callie again? Do these people come back? I think that's one of the big mysteries of going to be going into season 3. And she realizes that Hawkins is home. And these people are her family.
Specifically, she realizes that Hopper is her guardian. And that's the person that the boys can help her. You know, they're her friends. They've taken care of her.
And they love her.
They can't provide for her. And their families are not her family.
Yeah.
Those boys are her family. You know, extended. But I think that she needs Hopper.
Yeah. And I think another thing that I really got from watching this and kind of online about it, and you know, people debating the Chapter 7 controversy, is that the people in the lab, they wanted to use L.
Yeah.
It's to a certain point. In a certain point in season 1, the boys wanted to use L. And you know, Joyce asked her to find Will, and Nancy asked her to find Barb, and she's really, in a lot of ways, she's used through most of season 1. And Hopper kind of didn't want to use her for anything. He wanted to protect her. He wanted to kind of really pour into her as a person. He didn't want to do any of that. And she gets to Callie.
I don't even know if that was the original intention of Hopper. I don't know, because we don't know what he discussed with the lab. We don't know what he did. But it's been a year. What is Hopper? How has he changed? Because of Eleven, you know.
Yeah, because I think it's very clear that, as we talked about,
he setting a trap for her in the woods. And now he's protecting her.
We never really kind of see what his intentions were, but we know what they've become. And she towards the end of the season, you know, of Chapter 7, she goes back and she's going back for her friends, and she's going back because they love her and she loves them. And I think that's really, really important. And then we get to Chapter 8, and then things have gotten really bad. And
the mind flayer.
Yeah.
So that's
it's a D&D
character. Character.
It's really funny because I love the part where Hopper's still dismissing all this. Oh, it's a kid's game. What's going on? What are you guys playing about? And Dustin's constantly trying to get the terminology right. And he says, talking about demo dogs. And everyone's looking at him like, kid, are you really? And I should tell you at this point that Daniel has brought out his D&D Player's Handbook, which I really need to get. But, and we see that they finally understand a little bit of what they're up against with the hive mind. And I love how everything that they actually get into has been talked about in science class about the hive mind and how that works and everything about that. And
what I love that in the story, that's what he uses. He brings out his player's handbook. They don't have the internet. You know, I can't do a Google search for what it is. But the thing is, Dustin is so well versed in that world that for him, this is the vocabulary that helps to, like, he can relate to that. So He's like, well, there's a supernatural thing happening. There's this evil character in real life. Let's call it what we can. Because this is what we have.
Yeah. So we talked about in the last episode, they really had gotten away from this playing D&D together. And it's kind of something that they used to do in their more D&D arcade games. But it comes back. I love how who they were and comes back. And that's going to affect who they're becoming and things like that.
Mind flayers, also called Illithids, are a source of sentient creatures across countless worlds. So they're just different types of characters. The Illithids hatch plots as far-reaching and evil as their fathomless minds can conceive.
And we definitely experienced that here because
there's a bunch of examples of Illithids, but...
Yeah. But, of course, as we talked about earlier, Chapter 8 is where Bob the Brain leaves the world. And
Someone had to go. Insidious masterminds that harvest entire races for their own twisted ends. Nice.
Yeah, it's definitely the goal here, but I think someone had to die in this season. Someone had to go to.
What if he's not dead? What if he's in the upside down?
What if one of the MWDog comes back inside of him or something like that?
I don't know, but. Well, also,
he seems mostly dead.
I think that he has a contract that was for a season, and that was part of a really clean way of treating that.
He could come in, he could have his influences on everybody, and he could go. But I do love the way he was eulogized, and where Mike brings up, you know, that Bob was the one who founded Hawkins AV and how he really is kind of their predecessor in a lot of ways. And
he was their teacher's, right?
Yeah.
What's their teacher's name, Mr. Clark?
Yeah, he was the one that he said he taught Mr. Clark everything.
In a way that he's
kind of been there for them all along. He's been part of their lives all along.
You know,
and didn't
it's so
even
funny
realize
you
it.
See Bob leave the gun on the counter. Yeah, and you're just like, obviously this is going to come back to bite somebody.
Yeah, but I think I still was surprised when they caught him and they... And they started eating him. I was still surprised by that.
Yeah,
still...
I think that was also because, I don't know, I feel like the filmmakers wanted to really make it a gruesome, like, horrible end because of how great of a guy he was.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, they definitely wanted that gruesome kind of, they wanted to bring more stakes to what was going on. And, you know, and it's kind of classic storytelling is that when one character dies, it puts everyone else in jeopardy. And
it tells you that these aren't just little dogs; they're vicious, like weird plant Demogorgon things.
Yeah, and of course, this isn't The Walking Dead. You know, a lot of characters have died in the show. No title or character, no person that really has any standing in the story has died.
Well, let me relate it to something else that I'm doing. I'm playing D&D campaign right now, and someone in our party died last night.
Uh huh.
And I don't know, you kind of get the feel like it was pretty sad because we had a plan and it didn't work out. And well, anyway, it all of a sudden we realized that, you know what, our characters can die and our dungeon master is not kidding around. And he's just taking it, everyone's taking it pretty seriously. It's really been fun, but it was a bit sobering. So it's the same thing. It's just my tie-in, so.
Yeah, it's amazing. We brought up D&D a couple times in this episode. I wonder if that may possibly be an episode in the future.
Have you ever played D&D?
I've actually played a couple times, yes.
Cool.
So, and that's not something I could ever imagine myself doing. I used to think that was like the lowest class of nerd.
But I think you're one to talk.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's, I'm definitely a low, I always thought of myself as kind of a high class nerd, but that's just me being a money whore or so, And also, towards the end of episode 8, we finally see more about Max and Billy. And to me, this is kind of a big moment in the series.
We see Billy with his dad.
Yes. And
which is the same. Okay, so Lucas helps Max escape when Billy's supposed to be watching her. And he's like, this is the funniest thing. I've heard many girls talk about Billy, that he's really hot because he...
Gosh,
he's smoking and lifting weights at the same time. I thought that was really funny.
That's
I've heard kind of several girls say that. Like, he's the ultimate bad boy because he's working out, drinking a beer, and smoking the same time.
Are they serious about this? I really hope they're not.
I mean, I don't think they're serious. Like, they would really think he's the greatest guy, but he's
that's part of
the sex appeal of that type.
Yes, and that's also definitely kind of a classic early 80s meathead thing where I've seen that you see that kind of in a lot of meathead movies where people are like working out and then they're going to take a puff on the cigarette. Definitely well, is an early 80s thing.
Isn't he looking in the mirror?
Yeah, he's looking in the mirror. And
I mean, there you go.
That's and he's.
I really wanted okay later when he gets beaten up a bit. I really wanted him to get hit in the face, like, really bad. Just because he's so such a pretty boy.
Yeah.
But
and I think the big thing about this is that I had still kind of held out wonder and thought, are Max and Billy, you know, like 11? Do they have something special? Is there something supernatural about them? And I think the Duffer Brothers did a master job of keeping that mystery of these two characters where we don't know who they are.
Well, yeah. And I really didn't think they had any magic.
Just because the way they're kind of presented in the trailer and the way that things went with there, I held out that wonder throughout the entire show, and then you just see that they're just two kids in a bad situation, and they have this terrible father / stepfather who yells at them and bosses them around and is abusive,
which is pretty scary.
It's really scary, and you see why Billy is the way that he is. He's lashing out and he's being violent and abusive because violence and abuse is all that he knows. And it brings this kind of real world element to the show that it's been missing a little bit. And you see that in the way that the way that Billy lashes out, especially the way he beats the crap out of Steve. And this is also two seasons in a row where Steve Harrington has gotten his ass kicked.
Well, but honestly, Steve is a much better guy because he has a conscience, he has a heart, and I feel like that's much. I'd rather see a character change.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what makes Steve a good character, is because he's not too cool to hang out with the middle schoolers.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, he's cool. He's also doing what's right.
Yeah. You know, that's kind of...
And that says a lot about him.
And I...
He's a lot braver than the other characters, too.
Yeah.
I think Steve is one of the bravest characters, because, I mean, he starts out pretty cocky and annoying, but he's quickly... he doesn't care. He knows... He probably isn't going to win Nancy back, but he's not doing it for Nancy.
No, exactly. I think that's the coolest thing about him. He's
doing it because it's right.
He's doing it because it's the right thing. He's doing it because he's developed an affection for these kids. And he you know, tells Nancy, it turns out I'm a pretty good babysitter. And it's kind of a... It's a really endearing thing for him to say. And we know that... And we know that he's going to be okay. We know that this guy who started out in season one is kind of the archetypal 80s movie villain that we want to see get his comeuppance is now a good dude. I think that's a great thing to see. But now we have to stop for a moment and we have to talk about when Billy meets...
So Billy gets beat up by his dad and sent out to go find Max.
At the Wheeler's place.
Yeah.
And he meets Mrs. Wheeler.
Who is in reading a romance novel with the guy on the cover looks very familiar. So she's reading this novel and she's in the bathtub with candles, a bubble bath, right? So she's really enjoying her downtime.
Yes.
But it's just set in a very different style all of a sudden.
Yes.
You see her as this sexy MILF kind of character.
Yeah.
Because you don't really look at her that way before because she's beautiful, but
yeah,
she's not been portrayed that way.
No, she hasn't been
given.
She hasn't
I think
been
it's
given...
fun because, you know what? I think it's funny. It's funny, but it's also interesting because you instantly see her as, over this whole season, she's had a glass of wine in her hand the entire time. Every time you see her, she's drinking wine. And the dad is even more and more either asleep or unaware.
Or he's just
realizing that...
He's just sitting in his chair.
Their story could be the most interesting thing, because did she marry him because she had to? Because
then they kind of went into that season one.
But
yeah, that's what happened.
If she's married for either the status or because of her parents or whatever, but she's not... Her needs are not fulfilled.
No.
She's drinking. She's reading a romance novel in the bathtub. And... Well, but you think they're the only two characters... Well, that's not true. But they're the characters you see... Kind of, I don't know, you wouldn't have seen them coming into the same room together, but he's going around and he rings the doorbell and she opens the door and it's just this, basically, it's the cover for romance novel.
Yeah, there's heat immediately and he's got his shirt kind of open and...
Well, his shirt is always open.
His shirt is always open and her robe is kind of like not, it's a little bit too...
Yeah, she's got her décolletage exposed.
Yes, it's very well formed to kind of accentuate her sexuality and you see this... You see this character who's had no sexuality whatsoever, who is just the worst mom in the history of moms, whose children are in mortal danger, and she's in the frickin' bathtub.
But it's funny that she's just yelling for her husband to answer the door, and she has to get out of the bath, go all the way downstairs, and she's like, oh. She's like, oh, you're just so sweet looking for those kids.
Yeah. It's just like,
I really wanted her to go with him.
In a lot of ways, yes, you really wanted her to get some.
But I think more interestingly enough, Derek's story is not finished.
No.
Obviously, because no we way. Thought it was so funny. And I don't know. I don't know how old he is, but he's probably of age, so it's probably not that raunchy. So
yeah, but and he's also the kind of character that kind of wouldn't care about that.
I know, but just for the show's sake,
yeah,
like, they wouldn't mind putting them together at least like quasi an affair because it's
yeah,
really
and,
funny.
And we learned once and for all that yes, Nancy's mom has got it going on.
Dumb.
And he kind of goes, and then...
Well, it's funny because he was kind of... All these boys are into Nancy, but you realize that the mom is like...
yeah, there's...
She's the fully evolved version of Pokemon, right?
Did you just make a Pokemon reference?
I did.
Wow, this... That's one of my have you nots because I've never played, watched, or collected any Pokemon because I always thought it was too cool for them. So...
clearly you were not too cool.
Clearly so. I'm not. But,
you're not cool enough.
well, who knows? I mean, who knows how the winds are going right now? And then we finally get to the end of the episode, and we see them. They're under attack. They're in Nancy. They're in Joyce's house, and they're under attack. And things
and you
are.
Know what? What a good place to be.
Yeah, yeah. We're this place that seems to always invite monsters and things like that. And then you see. You see the demo dog go flying through the window.
Yeah.
And it's this dramatic, cool moment. And then you see Elle come through that door. And it's just this... I came close to crying twice. And that was one of them. Just because it was so emotional to see her come through that door. And for Mike to see her and him to be so affected by that. And it was a really powerful moment for me. And then you get into and then in the last episode, you see her, you know, hug Lucas and Dustin and kind of tap Dustin on the face. And it's like, teeth.
Yeah. Well, and also, pretty awkward because the last time she saw Max, she tipped her off of her skateboard, right?
Yes. And she just jobs Max's out throughout
but
this
you
whole
also realize, I didn't really put it together, but... She and Will have never met.
Yeah.
Eleven and Will have never met.
No, they never have.
So,
and
because
still,
Will
they still
gone,
kind of, yeah.
And they still haven't met because Will is not in the scene. Because, refresh my memory, Joyce, Bob, well, R.I.P. Bob.
Yes.
Joyce, Bob, and Hopper are at the lab, right, with Will?
Yes, they've been with the lab, but now they're all together now.
Yeah, and they're with... What's the guy's name? Owens?
Yes.
Owens has actually really turned out to be pretty cool. Because you find out he's still alive. He's like in the stairwell.
Yeah.
He's not dead.
Yeah, and you find out that he's somehow survived all this. Basically because they go and attack. They go and attack Joyce's house. So they survived that. And the other moment that really got me was when Mike finds out that Elle has been with Hopper for all that time.
He gets really mad.
He gets really mad, and they go.
But you also forget, like they're allowed to have emotional instability because they're children. Still,
yeah,
you know
they absolutely should have that emotional instability.
Because that's the interesting thing about being between the ages of 11 and 16 is that you have all of the confidence, sometimes the confidence and the reasoning of adults, but you're allowed to not have the emotional stability, you know, and because you're still figuring things out, you know.
No,
but we do feel like we're mature, we feel confident, we have the right, our decision-making abilities come into their, you know, come into your own as a young adult, but that's where these kids, they're able to really fight and do all this, you know, pretty cool stuff, but it doesn't mean he can't break down and get angry and...
Yeah, and I would go even further than that, and just in people in our generation, people who are our age are still... You know, the idea of adulting has come up. I think that's definitely a word that our generation invented, where we do things that are adult and oriented. You know, we pay bills and we pay bills and have jobs and pay taxes and buy cars and make investments and do all this stuff. But we still feel like children in a way because, you know, our generation is so burdened by student loan debt and we're so burdened by by pay disparities and things in higher cost of living and all these issues that we're facing. And, you know, we've grown up in, with all these things politically that are happening around us, and so many, we live in a, so much, our generation is such a diverse generation, and with diversity comes all those problems. We feel these kids' pain. I mean, we look at these kids and we look at the things that they're suffering through, and we are them. Just as we're going to talk about when we talk about Star Wars, we look at Rey and we look at Finn and we look at Poe, and they're us. We look at these kids and we see us. And so when Mike has that breakdown and he's yelling at Hopper and he's hitting Hopper, and Hopper just grabs him and hugs him at this point, and you see the pain that Mike has been in throughout this entire year, where he's all he's done is wanted to see Eleven again, and he hasn't really been able to tell everybody about it.
He's frustrated. He's taking it out on the wrong person. He's taking it out on the wrong. Hopper really can take it, so.
Hopper understands the pain, and he takes it, and also you see, also, you know, just looking back at the last scene, and you realize that, you know, Mike's a lonely kid.
But Mike doesn't really have.
He doesn't really
have a great family life.
No, he doesn't have.
Back at them, like, he's loved, but his parents are checked out.
Yeah,
his
doesn't have.
His sister's, you know, is off with guys and her friends, so.
Yeah, and.
Also, he's been through trauma because their friend was dead, you know, and his other friend he believes is dead. He's had two friends.
Yeah.
He thought were dead.
Yeah, and he doesn't have the parental support, and when you see Hopper hug him the way that he does, and you kind of see that, it's Hopper saying, once again, hey kid, I'm here for you. And it's a really powerful moment, and I got a little teary-eyed when I saw that.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two moments that really got me teary-eyed. And Billy show up, and I think one of my favorite moments is the entire season is that
Billy doesn't show up until after Eleven leaves.
Yeah, which is
interesting because Billy's, the thing is, you don't have. Billy is not a threat if you have Eleven in the room.
No, because Eleven is
off. Honestly, Billy's not a threat if Hopper or any of these people are in the room.
No, but he's only a threat because Steve is alone with the kids. And Steve is left alone with the kids, and he has the bat with the nails in it. But Billy comes in and beats the crap out of him, and it's a really violent and visceral scene. You know, when you see the blood on his face, and you kind of see and you kind of hear. You know, bones crush his hands meeting his face. And have you ever actually heard someone get punched bare knuckle, you don't realize it sounds disgustingly terrible. And you kind of get that sense. And of all the people to actually do something, you would think, kind of based on your mind, that it would be one of the boys that does something, but it's Max. It's Max who figures out what to do in that situation. She sees the syringe with the knockout medicine in it, and she's the one who does something. She's the one who acts. And it's this really powerful moment from Max, and that just cements her as a character that you love, because that she's the one who handled this. If you didn't already love Max before, you love her after she does that, because she just goes in there and is just a boss. And she's reading him the riot act, and she says he's passing out, and he's saying, "You're not hurting me. You're not hurting my friends ever again." And it's just this powerful badass moment that Max has.
But I feel like he will.
Yeah.
That's not a good story if he never comes back.
No. That's one thing we'll get into is when we talk about, start the preview season 3. And then while this is happening, they take Will to the cabin, and then they're going to get that thing out of him. And it's this really, and we talked about it before, this kind of exorcist powerful moment that is going on where they've got Will, and they're trying to get this thing out of him.
I'm impressed that Hopper had so many heaters in that house. So did they take a heater from Joyce's house? Yeah, they did. They got a heater out of the shed, the infamous shed.
Yeah. That's a really visceral, powerful scene that they happen. And then...
Well, and she has to deal with the fact that, you know, she's potentially killing her son.
Yeah, and she's already had her boyfriend die.
Yeah.
So it's, once again, Winona Ryder not getting enough credit for her performance in this show. Just not getting enough credit. She's fantastic. And then we get the climax kind of the entire series of seasons so far where Hopper and Elle go down into this cave to shut the gate.
Oh, what a cool scene.
It really was a powerful scene where they talk a little bit in Beyond Stranger Things of how physically exhausting that scene was for both of those actors. And they go down and they're able, and Elle's, the power that Elle gained and that she was able to harness in chapter 7 of the show, she unleashes and is able to close this, to hopefully finally, probably not really, but for now, close this gate. And
well, and then another interesting thing is that they go down into, don't the kids have to go down into the tunnel?
Yes, they go into the tunnel to try to distract and try to get everyone.
So they go to, they find the part, even the hole that Hopper dug. Yes. That's where they go, right?
Yes, and they end up there and they're trying to, basically trying to drive everything away from
it. Oh, that's right. I forgot Will uses Morse code.
Yeah, he's using Morse code to kind of give them a message, and it's really, that's kind of a cool moment.
So, yeah, the cool thing is, the best part is that, Dustin is trying to get away, and he sees this demo dog, and it's Dart.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I think we needed that, because we needed payoff from that moment, because that was kind of a really weird little tangent storyline for him to have a little pet.
Yeah.
And it worked out better, because it chose not to kill him, which it's so interesting that if it has a hive mind, how does that one have an affinity for him?
Yeah, it is an interesting thought. It
doesn't make sense, but...
But Eleven's able to get the gate shut, and that's kind of the climax of the season. And you know, it really was a really beautiful, powerful scene that they executed. And then we kind of get the climax, or kind of what would you call it? The resolving motion.
Yeah. Well, it's the climax, and then we have falling action. Yeah.
Yeah, we get the falling action here that we get. Start to kind of see, okay, where's this thing going? Because we see Dr. Owens meets up with Hopper in the bar, and he gives Hopper a fake birth, a real fake birth certificate for Elle.
That's right.
And her name is now Jane Hopper.
So he didn't die.
No, he survived.
Owens, it's good.
And we see that the tape that Murray sent off to Chicago Sun-Times about what happened with Hawkins' lab, the watered down one that they cook up.
Agreed to tell.
And it comes out in the papers, and we see them leave the lab. We see Hawkins' lab get evacuated and leave, and we see Murray kind of with the triumphant look on his face. We kind of get a vision of that as they're leaving the lab, and there's finally some hashtag justice for Barb. She gets to have a funeral, and that kind of resolved that story for now. And
justice for Barb.
Yes, and...
Is it really justice for Barb? Because she didn't... I mean, the justice is that they killed the Mind Flayer. Or they trapped it in its dimension.
Yeah, they've done the work, and what killed her is... Well, the Demogorgon that killed her is gone, and now Hawkins' lab has been held somewhat accountable, and she's had a funeral, and her parents don't have to move and sell everything. So there's been some justice. And she also got an Emmy nomination, so there's been some justice for Barb. I mean, she's become one of the most iconic characters of this show. I mean...
Okay. Sure.
Daniel's not buying the whole Justice for Barb.
I mean, I'm not saying that... Like, yes, I think she's only in two episodes, so...
But she made such an impact throughout this entire season.
And because she was...
She's become this iconic image for the associated with the show.
That's kind of irony. That's an ironic thing.
But it just goes to
People
show you with
just
all
doing
these...
People were doing that because it's funny.
Are you sure? I don't know.
Yes.
But just, I think her as an image was just so, became this iconic thing.
I think if they wanted her to be more prominent, they would have made her more prominent. Because her storyline only became complicated a couple moments before she died. Like, yeah. She was crying on the diving board.
Well, they didn't intend her to be this big thing, but she became this big thing because
it was ironic.
Because of,
I think.
I don't know. I think part of it was the iconicness of her appearance with the glasses and the mom jeans and everything like that. And then just like she just gets the wrong end of the deal. And I think I think a lot of people can associate with getting the wrong end of the deal. Your friend's up here banging the popular guy, and you're down here getting eaten by a Demogorgon. I think a lot of people can relate to that. And I think
I can't relate to that. Never happened to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you've never been eaten by a Demogorgon where your friend's been being the hot guy. So,
I just can't relate to Barb.
Well, not all of us are the coolest people on 2 feet, Daniel.
Okay.
So, a couple of foreboding actions. We see Dr. Owens tell Hopper, lay low for about a year. Let things play out.
He says not to really let Elle out.
Yeah.
In public.
Yeah. He basically tells him to lay low and let things kind of pass. And but it's kind of an indication that okay, we still got there's still things that might go on here. And then we see the shadow monster. We see at some point we see the image of the Shadow Monster. It's one of the last things we see.
Well, yeah.
We see that this thing is still alive out there, and still alive and still out there.
Well, another a loose end is that Callie is still out there, and we know yes. that she can create visions.
Yes.
Almost like a holographic image, because she created, Papa, what's his name?
Brenner.
So, the fact that that could be a potential conflict.
Yeah, I mean, will these people at some point go looking for Ellen? Will they find her, and what happens when they do? I mean, there's definitely this tension that there's inevitably going to be some kind of face-off between Jane and Callie.
Uh-huh.
That's just in archetypical storytelling fashion. That face off has to happen, and I cannot wait for that to happen. They might save it for a couple of seasons because they've, of course, it's been greenlit for season 3. They haven't started shooting yet.
Well, does it have the longevity? Does it need to be multiple seasons? Does it need to be 5 seasons?
Well, I don't
or,
think...
It, or is it better to just tell a really good story?
Yeah, I will...
Because I honestly could have been happy with them ending it right here.
I honestly could have too, because...
That's what I mean. I because the ending great. Was so good. I love more content, but when do you decide to stop writing?
Yeah, and the miracle of the season is that it was so good. Because, I mean...
Sophomoric
Yeah, that they were able to take what they did in season 1, and if anything, they expanded the world, they included more characters... Most of them were howlingly funny. They created new icons. You know, Meow Meow the cat has become an icon. I mean, there's some, you know, there's a video on YouTube about him where they show Netflix employees Meow Meow, and it's pretty humorous. They've created that image. We have, and also Callie with the whole detour, the guy that they go after says that Brenner's still alive,
mm-hmm.
and there's that because we don't really see. What happens to Brenner at the end of season 1? We see that the Demogorgon is bearing on him, but we don't see if he somehow gets away or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible that he's still alive. We don't know for sure that he was killed at the end of season 1. We just only assume and he hasn't shown up. So there's that threat there. It's been greenlit for season 3, and I wouldn't mind hearing it end after season 3. They've said the original plan was to go 4 seasons, and now they're saying they're going to go 5. So, So that's... They're planning out for season 4 and 5, and they don't want to go any further than that. And I think that's smart.
Well, the obvious next step for me is that we had this, you know, magic moment where Eleven and Mike kiss at the snowball, and that's a really nicely tied up thing. So I would assume that the next step is for them to have to figure out the next step. Do they go back to being friends, or are they having this little teenage relationship drama?
There's that there, and really the snowball is. The snowball is very seminal. I really
and the music in the snowball.
Yes,
is so
absolutely.
Great.
I mean, I mean, some of the choices. I mean, time after time, that had to be there.
Yeah.
I mean, you cannot find a more perfect song for that moment, mostly because it brought me back to them.
I just appreciate how well they researched everything. Because I mean, they were there, but to look at them, okay, this came out of this month, this year, you know.
Yeah, the music is. I don't think anything. No music in that show that actually came out after 1984. I mean, the thing we saw with Ghostbusters, and I mean that time after time, that I loved it because one, it, just the way my mind thinks, I think of that song and I think of Napoleon Dynamite. Oh gosh.
Okay.
And then you get Every Breath You Take
by
Sting.
By Sting.
Perfect. Which what was funny is that I heard this song on the radio.
Well, it's The Police, right?
I'm not sure if that's Sting or The Police, but another iconic song from that time that we get for that moment. And but I loved it because the snowball was, you remember Mike talks about the snowball at the end of season 1, and it's kind of this dream that he's had, you know, be at the snowball with Eleven, and
and
gets that.
As somebody who works in the entertainment and the event industry, I don't know if that school really could have afforded to decorate that. I'm serious. Like, you see the decorations in that gym. I'm like, okay, what parents and teachers put that up? What cherry picker was rented? Do you know what I mean? Like, come on. Sorry. It was very beautiful.
Yeah.
But I'm like, really? They're going to hang balloons up like that at a high school? No, middle school.
At a middle school, yeah.
No. I call bluff on that. Yeah, it's great for Hollywood.
It's great for Hollywood. It's great for the moment. And but Daniel's taking issue with the decorating. But hey, it's an affluent place. Hawkins is kind of, you know, judging by, you know, Mike's house and the fact that they're all Republicans.
I love that Jonathan and Nancy are at the ball.
Yes.
And then Nancy dances
with Dustin. Because Dustin, you know, Steve drives him to the dance, which is a cool detail.
And then Dustin has this little cool hair.
Yeah, he's got the thing in his hair, and he's got his hair up like this. And he has to, quote unquote, let Lucas get the girl. I mean, and Lucas and Max have their nice little moment that's really cool. And Dustin, he just jumps in there with no fear and is asking all these girls to dance. And they're all saying no in their mean girl ways. Yeah, they're all ratchet anyway. But then Nancy has this moment where she dances with Dustin, and it reminds me of what happens in the movie The Wedding Singer, where Adam Sandler has Drew Barrymore dance with the boys being bar mitzvahed, and because the other girl wouldn't dance with them, and it makes him look like the most badass guy in the world that hot girl wants to dance with him. So it's a really cool moment that really kind of it reminds you that Nancy's a good person because she's been through a lot in this show. And she also has the great moment where Hopper has the other gun, and he's looking at Jonathan like, do you know how to use this? And then she's like, give it here. It's just, you know, it's a great badass moment for Nancy, and she has a lot of those throughout that show. And it's important to me that I think that she has those kind of moments because she's the older female, and she deserves to kind of have her moments. And I really enjoy that she had those two moments, and we know that she's a great person. Really good song the whole time.
You know what's interesting is the song, the police song.
Yes.
What are the lyrics?
Every breath you take, I'll be watching you.
And then who do we look at the very end?
The Shadow Monster?
Yeah. So it really is the Shadow Monster song.
I'm gonna associate this song with the Shadow Monster.
I think they said that in Stranger Things, Beyond Stranger Things.
Okay. I haven't watched all of those, but I definitely will now.
It's a Stalker song, right?
I think it's now a Stalker song, and you said that.
I think I've heard that before. No, I've heard that before. I'll be watching you.
Yeah, it's a little. It can come across a little stalkerish. I'm sure that's not the intent of the song is not to be stalkerish, but while we're on the subject of 80s music, before I know what's coming here, I like to listen to 98.1 FM here in Lubbock, For one, a couple reasons. One, it plays a lot of great 80s music, and now it's a 70s and 80s station, and now you're getting some 90s songs incorporated with the music, which is actually, one, makes me start to feel really old, and two, that songs that I grew up with are now on this station, and two, it's just kind of, it just makes for a great musical palette, and they're playing the song Jesse's Girl, Rick Springfield, which is just brings all sorts of conflict into the that could be the song for Dustin, Lucas, and Max. Wishing I had Lucas's girl. So what do you think happens next? What do you think happens in season 3?
I don't know. I mean, I'm assuming we have a pretty slow rising action, I think, because you need to have character development
first. Yeah, and we did have kind of...
I don't think we see anything really that different. They tied up all the loose ends, I think.
So the only three ones that we have is Brenner alive, does Kelly come back for 11... And what is going on with the Shadow Monster?
Yeah, because I don't think Eleven wants to go back and see her mother again. I don't see that happening.
No, I think she's made her peace with what's going on with her mother. I think she has made her peace with that, yeah. And we kind of got that this season. We kind of got that that slow building action for the first couple episodes before we really got into the nitty gritty, which I really enjoyed. They said there's probably going to be a time hop of a couple of years. Yeah, which makes sense because... get more into the late 80s, you know, because they can talk about the boys. Well, one, these actors are all going to get a little bit older. So the boys will be embracing new cultural things. They'll get a chance to see Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. They'll have to live through the horror that is Howard the Duck. they'll see new things culturally. They'll have Nintendos. Okay, that's really awesome. Daniel's brought up the Stranger Things soundtrack on Spotify, and there's this little light that comes across the screen when you're playing the
and there's just, like,
theme song.
Really cool.
Oh, what's happening? I don't know. I don't know if they're gonna save the showdown with Cali for season four. They're gonna keep that in their hats for under their hats for a while. I think the fact that they brought up Brenner towards the end of that means that that's gonna come up, and I'm really excited. And it's not. I also have this theory that the next season is going to occur during the summer.
Yeah. Because we've had a lot of winter.
Because the last one kind of went down through around Halloween, and that kind of was the building block for all this. But also think about this, Steve, Nancy, Jonathan, and Billy are all going to graduate from high school.
Yeah.
And presumably they're going to go away to college. Presumably.
That didn't have to happen.
And I think to get them involved in the story, there's going to have to be something where it happens during the summer. Either it happens during the summer or during Christmas, which is another possibility. But I think I somehow think that the next season is going to happen during the summer. It's going to involve whatever summer movie was big in the summer of 86 or 87. I don't know what comes off the top of my head as far as those years go. That's how they're gonna introduce the next season. And as to what happens, I think Brennan will show up. I don't know. I think they might keep Callie in their head for a couple of seasons, as I said. But we're going to have to wait a while, and it's going to suck.
It's all right. Honestly, there's so much good TV and good stuff out. I think it's worth waiting for.
Absolutely.
And plus, there's some other really cool stuff we can talk about in the meantime. Have you ever seen Sherlock?
No. I've watched Sherlock. It's not really my thing. But
oh, man. So good.
Is that another have you not? Is the fact that I've seen the first episode of Sherlock. And of course, we're in peak TV.
I don't know, man. This is...
We're in peak TV times. We're in a golden age of digital television.
It's also and we're in really, the long really lucky. Form British episode format. So every episode is a movie.
Yeah, every episode's
like 10 seconds long. And they are mostly standalone. So there's plenty of other things we could talk about. So
yeah, I mean, it's just Stranger Things has been, to me, is one of the greatest pieces of American art I've seen in my lifetime. I've just been so wrapped up in it. It's just maybe it's just my desire to be back in the simpler time of even though I'm a 90s kid, just being back in the 80s and around all these things that are culturally excellent and familiar to me, that I just like being back there. And I love seeing these characters. And even though I'm an adult and all these things, I relate to these teenage characters so well, and I feel their pain, and I feel other than me, while I've never faced on Demogorgon, I feel like I've walked in their shoes a little bit, and
yeah,
that's cool. And also, I'm going to be knee-deep in books and seminary and all that stuff for the next year. I'm not going to have time to watch anything anyway. It took me almost 2 months to be able to watch this whole show, and it's been out since October, and it took me 2 months to watch it. And it's my favorite show. So that seminary is really, really busy, people. That's a story for another podcast, but I'm really, really wrapped up in school when I'm there. But we're going to go ahead and wrap things up now. Duffer Brothers, thank you so much.
Yeah, this is a great show. Thank you guys for making it.
For making it. Thank you, Netflix. We pray on your altar. We thank you for all you're doing. We thank you for all you've done. And we pray that that the end of net neutrality does not happen so you can keep giving us this content and we don't have to pay an obscene amount of money for it. So, hashtag save net neutrality. but we thank you so much for listening. And like I said, next time, we're digging into Last Jedi. So,
Yeah.
Get your popcorn ready and be prepared because we ain't going nowhere.